right. We have one case on our 10:30 docket, Pearson versus Stewart. Megan, if you'll announce counsel, please. All right, Mr. Elkins, I understand only the appellant will be arguing this morning, but welcome.
Thank you. Good to be before the court again. I think this is the first time I've been before the court in this location. So
oh.
Nice
well, it has been too long then.
It has been too long. I was at the old courthouse many times and always enjoyed the historic value of that. I have come this morning only to appear briefly. I wanted to address a couple points in the two issues before the court, and then thought that the court might have some questions that I wanted to be able to answer that a brief might not have answered. Excuse me. Let me open by saying that there is an error on page 11, something of an error on page 11 of the brief. Page 11. There is reference to a motion for extension of time to mediate the case. That motion is the subject of issue number two. We say in the brief that motion was granted, and it sort of was. But what happened was we took that motion to the presiding judge. She overruled it orally. I presume I had submitted the proposed order with the motion. She denied it orally, but several weeks later or some time later, I received a order granting it signed by a different district judge. So, so.
Can you clarify one other thing in regard to that motion? it's described as motion for extension, but was it an extension for time to mediate, or did that necessarily include an extension of time to actually have the trial setting?
I really was not seeking an extension of time for trial.
Okay.
What happened was we had not mediated, and we were coming up on the court's deadline to mediate. And I felt I was concerned I didn't want to just ignore that deadline, but we hadn't mediated, and I wasn't having any success in getting mediation scheduled, and I thought the appropriate thing to do was to at least seek to mediate the case. I didn't know whether it was going to go to trial when scheduled, but that was all I could do to keep from simply ignoring the court's order.
But basically, you already had a firm trial setting.
We did have a trial setting at that time, yes. The first issue is with regard to the trial court's conduct in what we see as a failure or refusal to hear the Rule 329B motion to modify, correct, or reform the judgment. We were in the process of presenting that motion when the respondent objected and claimed that the Rule 329B motion was barred by Section 156.401 of the Family Code. The trial court accepted that objection, and we have set out part of the court's rationale in the brief. Chapter 156 of the Family Code provides for filing a new lawsuit to modify a previous court order, a previous decree or order with regard to the support or custody of a child. So it controls the filing of a new lawsuit to modify, which was not what the 329B motion does at all. And the 329B motion was intended to correct what was found to be a miscalculation in the amount of child support. I don't like to overuse the word irony, but it's interesting that at the same time that we had the hearing on the 329B motion to try to correct what we thought was a miscalculation in the amount of child support, the respondent was in there with a motion nunc pro tunc to change the amount of child support in a different direction or one aspect of the amount in a different direction. So that was her way of getting that changed, or the respondent's way in getting that changed. And I had taken the Rule 329B motion as the what I thought was the appropriate way to get that changed. And so the nunk-pro-tunk went through, but the 329 did not go through because it was held to have been inconsistent or have been erroneously filed in the face of 156.401 of the Family Code.
Well, under Rule 329B, though, the trial court's not required to have a hearing, is it?
Well, I've always thought that it was. I've not, the courts, I guess, always have the ability, even on a motion for summary judgment, to decide that in camera without taking oral argument.
Or let it go to being overruled by operation of law.
Right.
What would your harm be? Can you address the harm analysis?
Well, the harm analysis would be the great expense of having to have brought an appeal to get the erroneous amount corrected. I hope that I'm not going outside the record and saying that my client was a single mother with two young children, had a relatively low income that she was making, and so what the harm to her that has transpired over the year since that was done is that she is receiving less than what I believe is the correct amount of child support to which she was entitled. So we may be able to make this up if this case is remanded to the trial court, but that's not going to do her and her children much good over the past year. So that is the harm that I would articulate from her failure to have corrected the order at that time.
But you're not asking for the order to be reformed by this court?
I'm not, because I don't know that this court has the information before it that would enable it to reform. That is, the calculations and all are in the trial court. I did not bring all those numbers up. There's an inconsistent amount of bonuses that are awarded from time to time. And as we'll see on addressing the second point of error, there are still some missing check stubs or payroll stubs that we still don't have all the information for. So that's why I did not ask this court to crunch those numbers and come up with it, because we don't have everything that we need really to even come to that calculation. Or we didn't at that time. Hopefully those documents are available now.
Mr. Elkins, was there any question about the timeliness of your Rule 329B motion?
I don't believe so. It has long been a thorn in my side that you can file by mail, but the clerks do not file stamp the documents at the time it was shown to be mailed, but instead the time that they receive it. So we always keep proof that it has been filed on the day that it has been mailed on the day that we contend under Rule 5 that it was mailed and filed that same day.
So the only issue is, did the trial court err in applying Chapter 156?
Well, or in failing to, I guess, in applying 156.401 and in failing to rule on the 329B motion.
Okay.
And I don't believe there was any jurisdictional challenge raised. I note that there was a comment in respondent's brief that just kind of suggested it was 47 days, but I think that was a result of looking at the file stamp, not the date of mailing. Let me quickly go to the sanctions part. The courts have limited the ability of the trial judges to issue sanctions so that it's, as one court said, so it's not a result of the judge being angry or you know, sanctioning out of anger, as opposed to having some context in which to have issued the order. This arises from the motion for extension, which I will confess was not well drafted, not well worded, and I take responsibility for that. I should have gone back and edited it a bit before that went out. But there is no evidence that statement was not correct, and we believe it was incorrect in the same way that, I mean, it was correct in the same reason that I'd said before. There were still 13 of these pay stubs that we had not received at that time after numerous requests. Now, our requests were all informal. I like to do that when I can, is to engage in informal discovery instead of having to go through the rule process. And so we had made informal requests for these documents and had gotten many of them, there's no question, but there were still 13 as of the time that we went to trial, 13 that we still had not received. In response to what is perhaps poorly drafted but not a gross miscarriage of justice or whatever the various characterizations that have been applied to it were, we had that. In response to that, the respondent filed a 121-page motion for sanctions, which is what makes the brief that you have before you so lengthy. But it still does not prove that there were not the husband's personal employment payroll records produced. So I'm not sure what the purpose of it was. But getting to the specificity of the sanctions, Chapter 10 sets out a good standard for guiding rules and principles. And it specifies in there when the attorney should be sanctioned instead of the client, and when the client should be sanctioned, and where perhaps both of them can be sanctioned. In this case, if there's any fault resulting from the poor drafting of one sentence of that motion for extension of time, I would certainly have thought that sanction would have been directed at me. I'm the one that drafts the order. My client didn't even sign off on it in any way. But instead, the trial court directed the sanction to my client and sanctioned her for attorney's fees and sanctioned her for our asking for the records, the payroll records, constituting a burden and expense on the respondent. Since it was informal discovery, the respondent had a right to say, "I'm not sending you anything. Send me a formal request for production, if you want documents." So the sanctions were inappropriately tagged toward my client. The amount had nothing really to do with the case. There was no indication of where that number came from, how it was pulled out of the air, or whether there was some specific calculation that went to it. But this is, again, there was no burden on the respondent because they had every right to say, "I'm not sending this to you until you send me some formal discovery." So that's why I believe the court's order with regard to the imposition of sanctions is incorrect. And I see yellow, and I see no more questions. Okay. Well, it was nice to appear before the panel, and I thank you for your attention to this.
We thank you, Mr. Elkins. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing. Your case is submitted, and you are excused.
All right.
The clerk will now adjourn us.